Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode.
It's a high-risk sport to be part of and to work with.
I'm paying you for podiums. I'm paying you for stage wins and jerseys. You must start delivering.
So we try and encourage minimum sort of 9, 10, 11 hours of sleep a night. They are just as prone to getting saddle sores as your weekend warrior. We don't trust anybody outside our own medical circle.
3,460 kilometers, 21 stages, 5 mountaintop finishes, and 30 uncategorized climbs. This is the challenge that awaits the top professional riders at this year's Tour de France. So what does it take to ride and finish one of the world's toughest sporting events? My name is Mike Finch, and as usual, I'm here with my co-host today, Professor Ross Tucker, and we're talking all about the world of professional cycling, and particularly the Grand Tours, with Dr. Adrian Rotuno, the team physician for the UAE Team Emirates Pro Cycling Team. Adrian is a sport and exercise medical physician with a Bachelor of Medicine and Surgery, a Master's in Sports and Exercise Medicine, a Bachelor of Science in Physiotherapy, and a Bachelor's degree in Physical Education. He is also a full-time clinical partner at the Cape Sports Medicine Medical Practice based at the Sports Science Institute of South Africa and also the consulting race doctor for the EPSA Cape Epic. Adrian, welcome. I know you're about to head off to the Tour de France in a couple of weeks' time. We're doing this a bit ahead of time. How's it looking? You were talking a bit before we started the podcast about how hectic that race is to be part of. It's very different from the other tours that you've been involved in.
Hi, morning, Mike and Ross. Thanks for having me today. Tour de France is the pinnacle of world tour professional cycling. So, often touted as the toughest race in the world. It's got significant pressure on athletes, significant sponsor pressure. It's watched by millions around the world. It really is in the eyes of the public anyway, the pinnacle of the hardest race around the world. So yeah, the pressure and the build up to it is always intense, and getting all your ducks in a row and regarding athletes is critical.
When we talk about cycling and doctors, of course, the one thing that always everybody thinks about is we've read so much in the media about these sort of things. When you decided to take on this job of getting involved in cycling as a doctor, did you have this kind of, it's obviously a tough decision because there's all these negative connotations around doctors and cycling. I mean, were you concerned about that when you took on this role, not only with the UAE team, but of course with Dimension Data for 5 years before that?
Yeah, it's a very valid question, and it's not a past tense. I was concerned. I almost am concerned. It's a continual thought at the forefront of my mind every time we are dealing with professional athletes, and whether it's cycling or other sports, in fact. But obviously, given the nature of cycling and the history of its doping culture, it's a high risk sport to be part of and to work with, and particularly when you're at the forefront of the medical care. If there's a positive or an athlete lights up for some reason, the first person they look at is the medical doctor or the medical team, essentially.
Yeah.
And so yes, you know when you sign up and you put your pen to paper and you agree to work with the teams, you always take your career and your reputation in your own hands. So it's a continual concern always. The best way that I justify to myself is that I love endurance sport, and I particularly love cycling and the sport of cycling and the physiology and the medicine behind cycling. The second thing and the most important thing is that to try and be as transparent and clean as possible. And to make that, the aim is to try and make that as publicly available as possible. So that the public, you know, in the past, the public has always called into question, there's conspiracy theories, et cetera, about the behavior of medicine and doping, et cetera. And my goal and our team's goal is essentially to be as open and as transparent as possible. And in doing so, hopefully, you know, we can navigate the way through that minefield of positives and come out the other side and saying, actually, you know, we manage a clean team.
I guess that there's always the sense from the public out there that there's pressure on doctors to be part of what they see as the sort of cabal of doping, the omerta that they talk about. I mean, is it, did when you, before you took on these roles, did you kind of look at this and say, okay, I need to investigate this further so I don't put myself in a position where I'm pressurized into something I don't want to do? I mean, do you take due diligence in doing that, or was it just having the right conversations with the right people?
I think it's both. You know, you certainly have to do your background checks, and you have to look who you're working with, et cetera, et cetera. And it's always difficult because, again, given the nature of sport, it's difficult to know exactly what you're working with 100% of the time. So a lot of it is you are taking, for want of a better phrase, a leap of faith in terms of, you know, agreeing to work with people. But, you know, once you're in the system, you know, the aim is to try and get protocol in place where you change it from the inside, because that's essentially the only place it can change.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the goal. So absolutely.
Yeah. Like, I think most informed cycling people will link doctors to doping, and in their minds they will see Lance Armstrong and Michele Ferrari, right? Sure. Or Fuentes, or even in the 1980s. Even in the 1960s, the East German systems were really the first ones to introduce medicine to sports performance and preparation, and it was all doping related. So there is a stigma there. So what Mike's asking is I think, valid. So when you get the offer, what factors are you weighing up that would give you reassurance that you're not effectively risking your own reputation by association?
Mm. Yeah, to honest answer, not a lot. You know, it's very difficult to predict or to go armed with knowledge about who you're working with, and yes, you've got we know about history. You can read up and you can investigate and you can go armed with that knowledge. And definitely, I mean, that's absolutely something we do, and we make sure, you know, in terms of who we're working with and how we work with them is investigated to the hilt. But yeah, you absolutely take your professional reputation as a doctor, as a human being, because essentially that's what you get judged on, ethically, morally, whichever perspective you're looking at, and you take it into your own hands when you work with in this kind of realm. So, you know, it's very, very difficult. At the end of the day, you know, somebody has to do the job, because you need medicine, you need medicine in professional sport, particularly cycling. And as I said, in terms of our protocol, we aim to involve pure science and nothing else, no airy-fairy stuff, and obviously no doping stuff. And try and apply that and recreate a sort of new chapter and going forward.
Yeah.
And I think it's a new wave of medical care, not just cyclists and cyclist attitudes, but medical care that's coming into the sport now. Where the last 40, 50 years, it's just been old school thinking, old doping culture, because it's the only way to win. Whereas science is now being infiltrated more into the sport, and we're finding cleaner ways and healthier ways, essentially of hopefully getting the same out of athletes.
Yeah.
It's a continual testing ground.
So you spoke earlier about the Tour de France being this pressure cauldron, and you mentioned sponsor pressure. So how does that sponsor pressure manifest, and how do you as a doctor insulate yourselves from that pressure to win? Because there will be countless scenarios in the past. We've heard it from people once caught, that they came in with every intention in the world to be clean, this culture that you mentioned. But then they're not winning. And the sponsor starts saying down the phone lines or in person, I'm paying you for podiums. I'm paying you for stage wins and jerseys. You must start delivering. And the easiest way to deliver would be then to give in to that temptation, because you can look for pennies, but there's $100 notes on the table. So how do you insulate yourself from that pressure?
Yeah, it's very difficult. Because at the end of the day, you know, if there were no sponsors in cycling, cycling would cease to exist. Mm. And so you're heavily dependent on that financial, you know, support. As a team, every rider gets paid. It's their profession. And you know, the hardest thing in terms of expecting a rider to perform if they're not performing is forcing them to say, well, you know, it's basically shape up or ship out. And the most difficult part about sponsors is you know, you exactly that. You get the call down the line, and often, you know, the down the line of management, where obviously sort of head management, they will first get the call and say, listen, what's going on, etc. So just to clarify, there's pressure from sponsors, and there's obviously team pressure as well, because everybody's lines are on the jobs are on the line with this if your riders are not performing. So that's the one side. But the other side is that if there is enough pressure to where a rider is then forced to go and seek doping in outside of the team environment, where he goes on or she goes on their own steam to go and start doping, etc., to improve performance. The issue with that then is I've just lost my train of thought.
Any control over what they do outside of the team space.
Well, that's one of the hard things to manage, but and it's impossible. In fact, you know, you don't know because you lose touch of the riders. But if a rider comes back and they are then doping, and they're light up on a doping test, what happens? The sponsor doesn't want to touch you, and they withdraw everything. So then the whole thing collapses. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword where the sponsor's putting so much pressure on that rider.
Some sponsors. Yeah. Not all of them are so nervous about doping, but yes.
But, you know, you look at team contracts when you sign with sponsors, and in big red bold writing, that's one of the clauses is that any doping, it's absolutely a zero tolerance approach, and sponsors withdraw generally. I'm generalizing. But it's a very difficult position to be in for team management and for the rider, and often back to your question in terms of insulating myself in terms of medical care, I often let the science and the logic speak for me, and the facts basically. So if a rider is sick or a rider is underperforming for whatever reason, whether he's overtraining or overreaching, there's a numerous variables as to why that rider is not performing well. You know, that's the data you present, whether that's just team management or to sponsors, and you can't make stuff up. You can't say, oh, it's because of this, and go into the press and say, oh, you know, he had some sort of virus or an illness, and that kept him off, when actually his performance numbers are just not good enough. And at the end of the day, my job is to present facts, and if the sponsor doesn't like the facts, there's nothing we can do about that, unfortunately. At the end of the day, if a rider is human, and if a rider can only perform to a certain level, and at that stage in his career he's only built up to a certain level, then so be it. You know, cycling, you know, what you often don't see is that cycling is not a snapshot sport. It's not a one season sport. And you'll see with other riders, like, you know, look at Alejandro Valverde. Okay, he's got a slightly shady past, but he's gone through phases where he's crescendoed and decrescendoed and crescendoed, etc. And he's now, you know, always a questionable guy. But you look at Julian Alaphilippe. That guy in the last 2 years has had an absolutely, you know, phenomenal career.
Yeah.
But and he's crescendoing, and he'll dip again.
Yeah.
Same thing with Tom Dumoulin. So everybody goes through these phases, and it doesn't take one season. It can take 2, 3, 4 seasons to crescendo. So, you know, you often a rider gets judged on one performance. And sponsors judge, team management judges, but you've got to step back and you've got to look at the global picture of that ride and say, well, what are his numbers? What are the facts? We know what he can do. That's why he's on the team. That's why we've got a contract with the guy. But he's not there now, but he may take only until 2020 Tour de France before we actually get that out of him again.
Yeah.
And that's one of the hardest things to judge and to make people understand that it's not a snapshot sport. It's not a one race sport. It's not a one season sport. It is a multiple season sport over years.
Do you get guys coming up to you and saying, hey, Doc, have you got some of the good stuff? Amateurs? Have you ever had that?
It's mostly said in jest. So I generally just shrug it off with a laugh and don't say anything, just in case something gets recorded.
It's those amateurs that I worry mostly about, isn't it? It's those guys who want to beat their mates up the hills on the Sunday, saying, "Can you not just give me a little bit of the good stuff? Nobody's going to bust me."
Yeah, to be honest, that's probably my, in terms of doping, that's the area I'm most concerned about, is where it's happening at not the pro continental level, but at the continental level,
yeah.
And just under there, because it's that level of rider that, you know, there's a thousand riders there, for example, and only 1% of those riders are going to make it through, but those 1% have to be top of the 0.1%. Yeah. So in order to get there, you know, the doping control at that level is minimal. They have access to black market pharmacies and guys who are willing to make absolute fortunes and will make fortunes, you know, dealing in whatever products they're dealing with. So to crack up through to the upper echelons of those cycling worlds, that's the risky, that's the target market, in fact.
Yeah, and there's less control there as well.
Absolutely nothing. Yeah. When you get into the upper echelons, that's when the control comes in. So once you're in there, you've got a contract. You know, whether you can run with the big dogs, that's another question. But without whatever you're taking, it's always worrying, and particularly with the weekend warriors. I mean, you hear stories often of, you know, guys getting popped in
the 45 to 49 age group category,
masters categories, you know, and
that's about ego, though, isn't it? To a large extent, there's no money at play in all of those age groups, isn't it?
Absolutely not. It's not a, you know, what they are is they're frustrated professional athletes.
Yeah.
You know, you still think you're 25 and you think you can perform like a 25 year old, and you should have. I guarantee you, 90% of those guys who do that are would sit at a bar with you and tell you about the glory days. and want to live in the past and live those days and still think they can do that thing, that sort of stuff. Maybe it's also about body image at that stage, you know, staying fit and cyclists are complex organisms. And there's a lot of factors that come into play, but the health issue doesn't factor in. You know, the fact that you if you're injecting EPO, for example, and turning your blood to sludge, you know, it doesn't matter about the health effects or the spin-offs of that. You know, you may have a family you've got to worry about. No, at the end of the day, it's winning the masters category.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the health issue. I mean, one of the big controversies in this space particularly is the use of TUEs, therapeutic use exemption drugs. It's probably the most widely sort of publicized in the last couple of years post the Chris Froome case. Just tell us about where you sit with that and kind of explain what they are and how relevant are they, and should people be using them? In other words, I remember seeing a couple of years ago a poster up on a wall saying 13-year-old potential cyclist disappointed that he hasn't got asthma because he hasn't got the use of the TUE. I mean, it's got to the point where it's almost become a joke within professional cycling. Unless you've got asthma, you're not going to be able to perform. Is it a fair comment?
Yes, yeah, it is. It is. I think, you know, with TUEs is a, you know, in the past it was absolutely abused.
So maybe just, sorry to interrupt you, maybe just for listeners who aren't familiar, we can just explain what TUE means and how you fit into that system as a doctor, and then talk about its abuse as doping evolved and shed its skin, to quote one expert, to become something else, which I think is the big issue now.
Yeah, so a TUE is as Mike says, it's a therapeutic use exemption. So basically, it's when and not just in cycling, in any sport, obviously wider, the World Anti-Doping Association has a list of prohibited substances that have been put on a list because they are performance enhancing. Either they are performance enhancing, they're either dangerous to health, or they are against the ethical rules of whatever sport you partake in. So those are the three kind of reasons as to why they add drugs to that list. And in terms of the TUE, so if a rider or any athlete is deemed to be ill enough that they need a drug that is banned, the only way that you can get that drug is if a medical doctor then prescribes a therapeutic use exemption to say, rider X needs X or Y banned substance because they are not well enough to perform. And if they didn't have this drug, they would not be able to perform their relative event, and therefore they need it. And that's the basis of a TUE. And TUEs, they should be anterograde. In other words, you should apply for a TUE before you give the drug to the athlete. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, though, it's retrograde, when, in other words, they are given back, they are done post ingestion of the medication. And so you almost sort of think, is that coming out of, is that more defensive, or is that coming out of legitimate cause? Mm-hmm. And so that's where the doctor would come in, and obviously it's drug dependent as well. So certain psychiatric drugs, which are also banned and considered stimulants or sedatives, those need to be prescribed by a psychiatrist. You can't mm-hmm. You can't have a GP or any other doctor. It's got to be. So certain drugs also fulfill or need to be prescribed by certain doctors as well. So there's a slightly more detailed than that as well. So in the past, then, you know, TUEs were always easy to do, and often the TUE was kind of taken as completely valid. It must be true. No one's lying about these things. You know, the justification behind it has to be taken at face value and believed, essentially. For example, the Lance Armstrong issue with the cortisone issue.
Yeah,
you know. And taking, you know, taking cream for any topical steroid is allowed, because you don't, you know, it's been deemed that the systemic effect from a topical corticosteroid cream is not enough to be performance enhancing.
Yeah.
And it's beneficial enough to help with treatment. So saddle sores, yes, cortisone cream is one of the treatments for it. But you know, you'd have to basically, you know, either ingest that cream of that tube of cortisone cream or inject it IV or take it orally to become positive on a blood test.
So topical doesn't necessarily, absolutely wouldn't not give you a positive result.
Absolutely not. So yeah. so and it's a prime example is, okay, well, hang on a second. We'll just write a TUE and say, well, there you go. It's a cortisone cream.
Yeah.
And they believed it, you know, which is absolute nonsense.
You know? So that's the kind of stuff that you would use. I mean, in your experience as a doctor, you would, when athletes have saddle sores, that you would prescribe that without any problem.
Yes,
because it's completely medically needed.
But what's happening when they cheat it is that they will say they used the cream. Just if I'm paraphrasing you correctly, they'll say they used the cream, but actually they've used it or administered it in much more powerful methods, and therefore higher doses, therefore performance enhancing.
Yes,
but there was no oversight of whether it was legitimate or not.
Exactly, and that I'm talking past tense now. You know, that attitude and that protocol has changed now. But you know, people have kind of wisened up to the fact that, hang on a second, you know, you will never be positive if you're just taking a cream. It doesn't compute. Whereas if you're ingesting it or taking it, some either your modality of doping is incorrect, or your volume of the drug is and the actual type of drug is incorrect, then you're going to light up. And that's what happens with him.
Russ, I know you've got some views on this, because you've written about this in your blog before, about the fact that you believe that TUEs should be banned completely. I mean, does something like a saddle sore cream not deem to be something that is valid?
Well, if the topical administration of the corticosteroid isn't going to elevate the levels in the blood, then there's no benefit from it. So then there's no problem, right?
Which is why it's legal.
But, right, so that doesn't then need the TUE.
No, exactly.
But when we're talking about, so what we're talking about here is the oral ingestion. So this is tablets or injections.
So IV, and oral.
So a typical scenario where that happens is the cyclist has allergies or bronchitis or some kind of infection, chest infection. Cortisone is used to treat that, off they go. Now, my opinion on that, and I'd like to hear yours, is that part of being an elite athlete is staying healthy. So therefore, if you get so sick that you are reliant on what is actually a very powerful drug to keep you on the bike and to keep you going, then you're probably too sick to continue. So that's why I remember saying that TUEs shouldn't be allowed, because A, they seemed to be abused. The system was too open to abuse. You can correct me on that. But the other reason was that I just saw it as against the spirit of what makes one athlete better than the other. I wrote that in an article once, and at the very next conference I was at, the medical director of WADA came up to me, a guy called Alan Vernack, who I'd met before, pretty nice guy. And he said he'd read that and he takes issue with it and he wants to tell me why. So he explained that what typically might happen is an athlete will compete in, let's say, world championships, and there's pollen in the air, and they'll have an allergic reaction to that pollen. It'll trigger their asthma or some sort of bronchospasms and so forth. That athlete is going to run anyway. And so Ellen's argument was that by giving the TUE, you actually protect the athlete from potential harm. So say, okay, I can see both sides of this particular issue. I still don't necessarily agree, but I think what it leads me to ask you, Adrian, is at what point as a doctor do you say enough? I'm not going to treat this condition because it's harmful for you to continue exercising, as opposed to I'm going to treat it because it's less harmful if I did.
Yeah, so very, very valid points, and I think you know you can't exactly see both points of the of that argument. But I tend my general approach is that I'm also against 2Es in general.
Yeah.
I don't think that they warrant use in an athletic field. So when you're when you are putting a rider on a bike for 6 hours of the day and their heart has to range between 150 and 200 beats per minute. For those that 5 to 6 hour period, their bodies are in overdrive. Their bodies are calling on all reserves physiologically, mentally, whatever system you're looking at. And now you're going to go and put a rider because of whatever pressures, like you said, like a World Cup event and it's a pinnacle event, and they need to perform and a win is critical. You're gonna potentially, and that rider is now falls ill, whether it's a bronchitis or something else, where it's now becoming more of a systemic problem. Their health is called into question. My approach is that absolutely not. That rider, if you are requiring a TUE that is requiring oral or IV steroids, let's use that for an example, they are not well enough to partake in that event. Irrespective of where they, irrespective of the event, irrespective of the pressures on them, irrespective of the sponsors' wants and needs. So, right.
Because this is not, for folks listening, these are not insignificant drugs. This is not like going to the pharmacy and having the guy give you some over-the-counter anti-inflammatories or some paracetamol. Like cortisone injections and oil that's a pretty serious drug.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what has it been abused in the past is that it's an amazing it's a potent anti-inflammatory. It allows for healing, it numbs pain. You can recover faster. You get lighter. There are numerous benefits for it, and so that's why it is open to abuse. And there's always been sort of it's been a little bit dodgy in terms of its validity in terms of is this allowed or is that allowed, et cetera, in the past. And now there's more slightly clear cut rules, but my approach on that drug and particularly in TUEs is that, it's the rider's health is paramount. That for me is the first issue, and that I will not jeopardize a rider's health, because at the end of the day, back to the example of 200 beats a minute, the illness or the virus, whether it be viral or bacterial, and generally in these issues it's viral, and those are the dangerous ones, in fact, because those are the ones that go systemic. They cause issues with the heart. So you get viral myocarditis and other systemic effects where you get organ failure. And despite these athletes being super conditioned, they are like thoroughbreds. And thoroughbreds get sick a lot easier than a non-thoroughbred animal. So the point is that you don't want to mess with that. You potentially are ruining an athlete's career. And end of the stage, we see it often. We see deaths, particularly in mass participation events and race medicine. There are deaths of people who are running ill. And their system gets it's that straw that breaks the camel's back, and it pushes them into overdrive, and they don't have the capacity or the reserve to fight it, and they become ill. So you're potentially ruining an athlete's career. And then from my side and more moral, ethical sort of standpoint, I also will not give a drug to a rider that is going to give them advantage or benefit over another athlete or the rest of the athletes. And so personally, it's a bugbear of mine, and we don't prescribe those kinds of things. And secondly, it's against the nature of the sport. And thirdly, that with the social media and the focus on the sport, the last thing that you want to do, and this is more reputational salvage, I suppose, is be found to be giving drugs to an athlete and saying, well, hang on a second, who's to say that this rider was actually sick enough? Who makes that final call? Because the public are going to make the final call, irrespective. Whereas as the doctor, I've seen the patient. It's obviously patient confidentiality, so I cannot share that information. But I could say this rider was legitimately sick enough. He therefore warranted this drug. Therefore, I'm putting him in the race. I avoid that whole situation and say, listen, if he warrants the drug and that warrants a TUE, absolutely pull him from the race, and so be it. And it's cycling.
Yeah,
he will have a right. Keep him. Get him better, and he will ride maybe the Vuelta rather than the Tour de France and still get results. And that's my approach.
So just on that, and this is not a TUE issue, but isn't it incredible that drug for which you need a TUE in competition is not even banned at all out. So this corticosteroid that we're talking about, these are legal outside of competition.
Yeah. Yeah.
That to me is astonishing.
Which hopefully is...
I hope that changes. But just so for listeners, some drugs are classified as banned only during competition. And in competition is defined as, Adrian, what's the cutoff afterwards?
So it's usually within 7 days.
Before,
and then before and then
right after.
And then straight after, yeah.
So you could...
Just explain that a bit more for the average Joe like myself out there. When you say it's banned... not only banned in competition, in other words, there's seen as a performance and benefit for something in competition, but you can take it outside of competition even as a professional athlete.
Yeah, and so when there was an investigation done into cycling, I think in 2015-16, that CIRC report, and they got testimony from a lot of riders saying that this was the practice now, was to use these corticosteroids outside of competition. So as long as that cyclist knows that he's not in an event and a race, within 7 days, he can take this drug without any need for a TUE, without any need for disclosure, because it's not on the list.
Yeah.
Yet it still has the same benefits and allows potentially the training adaptations and other physiological advantages. And it's just, to me, extraordinary that this drug isn't banned outside of competition. I understand why, though. It's because it would create for them a logistical administrative burden of trying to monitor therapeutic use for 12 months of the year instead
of just a
events.
Lot of saddle sores. I mean,
but again, you can use the use the creams for that. It's just a bugbear of mine that I just thought of as you were talking about it. You know, and then is the same principle for you as regards painkillers?
Yeah, so painkillers also a fairly hot topic, and obviously now with the recent banning of tramadol as of March this year. You know, the issue with painkillers is that. Again, you potentially mask a lot of symptoms. So riders are in a sport that you are expected to be hard, expected to push through and grit and show grit and get through the pain. If you can help that rider do that, geez, you know, why not?
Well, we're talking obviously cycling, but I mean the scenario in rugby must be even more pronounced because a rugby player very rarely walks onto the field without pain, and at halftime he's in pain.
Yeah.
So where do you draw the line as a doctor as to what degree of painkiller would you prescribe?
Yeah, so
aspirin's fine, but where's it not fine?
Yeah, so it depends on the scenario, and it depends what the rider is complaining of. You know, so if bottom line is that if paracetamol generally in terms of endurance sport is one of the safest ones you can give. There might be some renal effects, but I mean, compared to what a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory like your typical ibuprofens or your Nurofens, etc., the effects on the kidneys and the heart and the vasculature are always something to be concerned about, which is why we always advocate in mass participation events, and particularly unconditioned athletes, you know, like doing the cycle tour or the Epic. You avoid those medications because your kidneys and your body's not used to it. You get dehydrated. The anti-inflammatory has already shut down blood flow to the kidneys. So already you are putting your body at risk. And so, you know, I've had riders at the Epic, in fact, who's broken collarbone, the bone is tenting the skin. And he said to me, strap me up, doc, and let me ride.
Give me a Marpredol.
You know, yeah. You know, and just give me some drugs and I'll chew those every hour on the hour while I ride. And now you've got to on races like that, you become a heartbreaker. And that applies to the professional cycling world as well. And you break the hearts of your fans of the team. You break the hearts of your sponsors to say, well, this guy's got a saddle sore, for example, that has become so severe that he cannot ride on a bike. He cannot sit in a bike. So what do you give him? Yeah, you give him numbing drugs. Fine. Topical numbing drugs, oral numbing drugs, et cetera, et cetera. End of the day, that guy's going to ride for 5 hours on the bike and he's not going to be able to, you know, you might as well take the seat off the bike and ride with nothing, because that is how painful it is. And you're expecting him to ride for another 2 weeks like that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you've got to face reality. You've got to examine that patient. You've got to say, listen, the benefits of this medication are, or the risks of this medication far outweigh the benefits, and your condition together with your examination, that's going to make up my mind. So yeah, I don't, you know, the general premise is that there's no abuse of pain medication. If they need something, we'll give it to them to get through. And generally it's also timing of medication. So, you know, you can give medication after they finish the stage and the night before, et cetera, so that you get the benefits of anti-inflammatories. But by the time they started the race the next day, the metabolites and the dangerous sort of side effects are generally out of the system by then. But you still hopefully have some of the anti-inflammatory or the pain or, you know, improving effects of the medication. So, yeah, pain medication absolutely is prone to abuse, which is back to the tramadol. It's the reason why, because it's sort of viewed as a gateway drug to take other substances, and also it's a potent drug. It numbs a lot of pain, and so the view is that it's a gateway drug, and also that you are potentially doing damage to your body should you wish to ride for 200 k's and push through if you've got a cracked rib, for example, or a fractured spine, you can still ride. You know, so when I say fractured spine, I mean, like a small bone on the side of the spine where it's a stable fracture. I mean, we've had riders in the past who finished the Tour de France and then afterwards they've had CT scans and three of their vertebrae have been cracked, you know, and they've just been living on pain medication. At the end of the day, if that's the case and the rider is too painful, end of the day, that's the end of his race, I'm afraid.
So it sounds like it's a first do no harm concept. That's what it boils down to. And that's... Yeah. TUEs and any other drug prescription. Yeah,
and that's the first premise of medicine.
So is there any way like that it's relatable to you then to think back to those doctors in the 90s when EPO was first being used and abused by cyclists without their knowledge? And these doctors are looking at this and saying, if we don't intervene here, we're going to actually like see our cyclists start hurting themselves, harming themselves. And so it seemed to me that doctors actually took ownership of doping for the protection of the cyclist. Is that a really distorted, warped view of medical ethics, or can you relate to it in some way?
Yeah, I think maybe only a handful of doctors did what you asked.
Sure, it was a handful.
Where the majority were the opposite.
Yeah,
you know, the majority were, you know, win at all costs. You know, and it also begs the question of whether they knew the side effects of that.
Right.
You know, I don't think anybody was actually aware of the health risks, essentially. So that's why those drugs were freely applied and dished out like Smarties and the question is whether or not, if something had happened, would they have stopped? I don't know. Whether doctors actually took hold of that at the time, I think that's where the seed was planted. That's where it started growing, and that's where then the research went in that direction to say, well, hang on a second, you know, what are the effects of X or Y, and people started waking up and realizing, hang on a second, this is not actually beneficial to the rider. The health risks are outweighed by the benefits, and it's not worth doing. And I think that's where it grew, but. Yeah, I think the converse or the opposite market of that was by far the dominant factor. I think now it's the other way, but I think for the last 60 years it's been the converse.
Yeah. I know we don't want to talk about drugs the entire podcast because there's lots of other interesting stuff we want to ask you, but one final question from me. With this thing like TUEs, if for instance you're an asthmatic and you need a Ventolin pump or something like that to get through a ride, if you're not an asthmatic, are you then going to get a benefit from an asthmatic medication?
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah, so, you know, the question is you need a diagnosis of asthma. You know, that's why we do, you know, every year we do pre-screening of every single athlete, and they do lung function tests, et cetera, et cetera. exercise provocation tests to see if there's a reversible airways disease, which is essentially what asthma is. And if they have a degree of reversibility and it's proving to, the numbers are showing that, hang on a second, their performance is significantly being impeded by this reversible airways or this inflammatory airways condition, then they would warrant it, and then they get diagnosed. Whether that's, you know, exercise-induced bronchospasm, which is just sort of asthma in inverted commas in relation to exercise or exertion, or whether they're not, they have actual asthma, which is, you know, in relation to other stimulants such as allergens or pollen or animal
dander. That's much more chronic.
Yeah, you know, whether they've had it since childhood, you know, you can grow into asthma. Most children grow out of it, but you can develop it as an adult. And often these riders are riding through different cities, different towns, and often in the fields. There's agricultural fields everywhere. So there are potential allergens floating around everywhere. Plus they're also in aeropanes the whole time, so in metal tubes with a whole lot of other, you know, potential stimulants. And plus they often, you know, riding, the season of riding is it starts in January in Australia, which is hot obviously, but then it moves over to Europe for the classics, and that's still freezing cold.
Mm.
And one of the classic stimulants is for airways diseases is cold air. And you're breathing in that cold air, and you're breathing in rapidly because you're obviously, you know, you're not humidifying it through your nose. So your mouth sucks in all the air, and that's just pure unfiltered ice cold air.
Mm.
And often you get affected. So it's also race dependent. But you know, if a rider is asking for a Ventolin and is not a known asthmatic in the team, then you need to start asking questions. And it's not justified. It's not illegal. Because it's a legal drug for anybody. It's not only legal for asthmatics. It's a legal drug as long as the dose is not above a certain amount, as per the Froome case. But the question that I would then ask the writers is, well, hang on a second, let's talk about your symptoms. It's not just a one-off thing. You haven't got a common cold, or you just got a mild, you know, post-nasal drip where you've got a little bit of a cough. Therefore, let's give you Ventolin. You know, so there's a lot of cycling is a sport that is steeped in mythical sort of ideas and old school thinking, and it's very hard to break that. And us as a sort of relatively modern medical team have come into this ancient relic of the sport, and we're trying to crack open these old wives' tales, for want of a better phrase, and it's difficult. So, you know, one of the things is that Ventolin is something that's going to open your chest.
Even if you're not asthmatic?
Even if you're not asthmatic.
Okay, yeah. So there is a performance benefit if you're taking it and you're not asthmatic.
Well,
it's going to make you better on the day.
The question is, if you have asthma, yes.
Yeah.
It's going to help you.
Yeah.
And fair enough, it should help you because you cannot perform, you know, with a closed airway.
Optimally, yeah.
Whereas if somebody doesn't have asthma, it's not going to do anything. You don't have a reversible airways disease, and you know, I'd rather try and unblock you from the top and give you nasal things and options rather than you know, right, an inhaled drug, as it were, whether that be a steroid or a Ventolin. So you know, back to that question, I would say to the athlete, well, then we possibly need to do lung function tests, do a full workup, do a symptom history. When are you getting these symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. And again, you know, you just want to avoid all of any unnecessary, you know, any unnecessary press as well, because one snapshot of the Tour de France of a rider taking a Ventolin puff, as you've famously seen the Chris Froome ones, which he is supposedly has asthma, but you know, of a rider, one of us who doesn't have asthma, and the public knows, you know, well, hang on a second, this rider doesn't have asthma, what's going on?
Yeah.
And that's wildfire, you know.
Well, that's, you see, and that's the problem again, and comes back to that word you used earlier about transparency. Because the public is informed enough to join the dots. And one of the dots that they use is the non-disclosure. So you'll read athletes' autobiographies, and there's no mention of it. Yet then you'll see them taking the pump, and they say, I've had it since I was a child. But see, those things don't compute. So again, there's an absence of transparency. And I think around the TUEs, around doping, around all these medicalization issues, if there was a degree of transparency, I think it wouldn't reassure people, but it would go some way to buying back some trust. But now, as a doctor, transparency is in conflict with confidentiality. So that's another tightrope for you, right?
Absolutely. Cycling has had a history of keeping cards very close to one's chest, whether that's athlete data, physiological data, blood parameters, whatever you're doing, because nobody else wants other teams to know secrets. And they don't want anybody to know, well, hang on a second, why is this team doing so much better? What is your secret? That's the eternal question. Are you driving the bus? You look at that bus. What's their secret? And secrets go right down to bus drivers. Why is that guy's bus so much faster than my bus?
Yeah.
You know, and it's amazing. It's this sport of absolute secrecy in a complete public eye. And so it's this contradiction. And I think that, you know, on your point, Ross, in terms of confidentiality, we obviously medical-wise and medical patient information, right information, we can't share that publicly.
Mm.
But things, like you say, like if somebody is suspected or, you know, claims to have asthma, for example, which is a childhood condition generally, and there's been no mention of it in the history, then all of a sudden it comes out, you know, when they get popped for an asthma drug, well, where does this come from? And that just it just smacks of smoke and mirrors, and there's no transparency. And I think,
and that's I mean, it's easy for me to say this because I'm not. But if I were an elite athlete, I would publish my lung function tests.
Yeah,
I would take ownership of this and I'd put it out there. I'd publish my training data. I publish my performance data. And everyone says, oh, you can't do that because then they know what it takes to beat you. But if I'm racing against Usain Bolt, I know what it takes to beat him. I have to run 9.71 seconds. It's not helping me do it. So the whole rationalization for secrecy for me also falls a little bit thin. Training data, maybe I can see you wouldn't want to publish that until after the fact, because that's a... in theory, a source of a competitive advantage. But
yeah, you could mimic that and try and get the same results. But at the end of the day, no rider's the same.
Exactly. So actually, I remember there was a rugby team in the 90s used to publish everything they did because they would say, well, our rivals will copy us and we'll evolve. Mm. So we'll keep them 1 year behind every year.
Oh.
And it was actually by publishing it that they forced people behind them. So the transparency thing's another bugbear for me. And the only thing worse than... not being transparent is promising it and not delivering it. And that's all that's happened in cycling for the last decade is, you know, even Armstrong, when he came back, I'm going to work with Catlin, we'll publish everything, never came out. Mm. Henao fails with these suspicious blood, we'll commission a study and publish it, never comes out. So it's hard for the public to buy into this until they see it done, you know? There's a lot of talk and very little action.
Absolutely. And our approach, and I say this, you know, we as a medical team looking after our team now we want to be as complete and transparent as possible. So, you know, if there's certain issues called into question where we have identified a rider's parameters as being abnormal, our protocol is straight away we pull that rider from the race. Internally, this is, you know, whether the UCI flags it as well, but if we see something, and that's why we do very close monitoring, we will pull that rider from the race. We'll conduct our own internal investigations. And whether that means, you know, you pull a rider and we do our own internal testing and we put him at altitude, we put him down at back at sea level, and we do serial measurements. Because again, it's not a snapshot. You can never do a snapshot value because, you know, if a guy's come off a training camp, his blood parameters are going to be sky high. And you can think, well, hang on, is that alien or is that just his natural reaction? Is he a fast responder? Is he a slow responder, etc.? Whatever the issue is. But you do serial measurements and you do a complete experiment and then you make that data public, which is what we plan to do. So, you know, the idea is that we want the numbers to speak for themselves. And, you know, you're always going to get your naysayers and say, well, hang on, this is not real data, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, the bottom line is we can only be as transparent as possible. And our idea in the new era of cycling, if you can call it that, is to be as open about that, because it leads back to reputation, it leads back to sponsorship, leads back to all the foundations of the sport. And if you don't have that, you just have this continual cloud of mystery and doubters, and the sport just goes down and down and down.
Yeah.
And it's the trajectory of it, unfortunately, is just continuing, but you know.
Yeah.
Still to come.
How do you, as the doctor, ensure that the rider is getting enough nutrition and enough volume? Because no one can physically fit that amount of food in. Our perennial areas are so conditioned. You know, it's like us sitting in an office chair every day. You know?
Well, let's move on to the actual mechanics of dealing with the team throughout something like the Tour de France. One of the interesting things is how you monitor this load versus recovery scenario, because every day those riders are doing massive kilojoule burns and massive fatigue. How do you make sure they stay healthy for 3 weeks? It's a long time to be healthy for, especially when your body's under load.
Not just for 3 weeks. I mean, yeah. 6 months leading into that. The preparation, I would think load monitoring is even more important, because if it's day 10 of the Tour de France and your data is telling you the rider's overloaded, that's too bad.
Well, how do you know the rider's overloaded?
He's on the bus. He has to keep going.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know that the average person will say if you wake up in the morning and your heart rate's more than 20 beats per minute, you shouldn't go and exercise because you're tired. Is it as simple as that in the professional space?
Yeah, so, you know, it definitely is more complex than that. And yes, exactly. I mean, Ross, you're 100% right. It's not just, and like I mentioned earlier, it's not a one-season event. You know, we'll have a rider and we'll say, right, we are planning for the 2021 Tour de France for you, you know, now. And so if you, for example, have a 21-year-old rider, you're not going to go and subject him to the hardships of a three-week Grand Tour. You're going to say, right, this is your build for this year. We're going to and you build in a very crescendo, decrescendo kind of way, where they peak towards their races. And this is all very, very clinically and clearly outlined in the beginning of the year, in the beginning of the season, which actually happens probably in October of the year before.
And is there a multidisciplinary team that does that, or is it coach, sports scientist, doctor, one of the three, all three? Like, do you have a group of what does the team look like that then, do you have a sit down meeting and say, right, let's talk Dan Martin 2 years?
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the job of the team doctor is health, is providing health, and that's acute health in terms of, back to your question, Michael, on a three-week race is maintaining that health.
Yeah.
But it's also chronic health and it's long-term well-being. So we monitor these riders 24/7, 365 days of the year. And how it works is, and our system is that each doctor gets assigned, or each rider is assigned a doctor. And that rider has access to that doctor 24/7. So we're permanently on call. And yes, I've gotten calls in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, for a stubbed toe. Yeah. You know, and or some nausea and vomiting or diarrhea, whatever the issue, and trying to talk a patient or rider through that at 3 o'clock in the mornings, you know.
So you said riders are assigned to a doctor. How many doctors? How many riders? What's the ratio? How does it work?
Yeah, so you know, on an average team, you've probably got 27 to 30 riders, and depending, because I mean, we in our schedule we have to cover over 340 race days in a year. So you're looking at more than practically a race a day. And so we have 6 doctors on our team. We have 4 South African physicians, and we have 2 foreign physicians, one based in Italy and one based in Germany. And it's you know, obviously being geographically where we are on the other side of the world, it's difficult for us to always get there. So we have the European-based side, who then can cross borders quickly and get to races quickly, et cetera. Or if something's gone wrong, they can hop across, or alternatively, the rider can make their way to their respective clinics. But on that as well, is that over the years, we've built up a very intricate network of referral systems and doctors, not only doctors, but multidisciplinary. So physios, biokineticists, dietitians, et cetera, who we have access to. And they're also in Europe. It's not like South Africa. In Europe, they're very cycling centric. It's a very, you know, it's a cycling centric sport, but a continent. But in Europe, there's a lot of cities that just naturally draw cyclists in. Like Girona, for example, is one of them. That just, you know, any given day you'll see a peloton of professional guys training on the climbs around there. Mm-hmm. So you tend to also put a lot of fingers in those cities to say, all right, hang on a second, we've got a physician here, we've got an orthopedic surgeon there, somebody who we can link in, somebody we trust, obviously. And then we build relations like that. So if a guy crashes, I'll speak to him after the race, and you know, by the next day we've arranged surgery, for example, in Germany, and he's operated on 2 days later, and his rehab starts, and so it's all about expeditious diagnosis, expeditious treatment, and then rehab, all in the aim to get that guy back to health. Because the problem with that is that, fine, you've got a team of 30 or 28 or whatever you've got. But if you pull one guy out, it has ripple effects not only on his race and his race program for that year, but it also has ripple effects on everybody else's program. Because now you've got to whip a guy out of the Vuelta and put him in the Tour de France, rather. So now his whole race program that you talked about in October is now completely on its head, and you have to adapt and move along like that. And with that goes in training, it goes nutrition, and particularly health. Because now you're saying, well, hang on, this guy his training program is crescendoing towards a certain point, but now you've taken him back and you put him into a massive 3-week stage race, you know, 6 weeks, a month, 2 months earlier than he was supposed to. What is his health going to be like? Is he in a condition? He may be in a dip, etc. He may have come off a hard block of training.
Yeah.
And so these are the factors that you have to continually monitor. So yeah, back to your question, we all sit in meetings and we discuss each rider. At the end of the year, you have a race brief where you...
Who's we in those meetings? Does it include the coach or do you coaches, separate the... Okay.
Coaches, doctors, so medical team, coaches, directors, sportifs, and general management, obviously, because they have a say. And then...
And those are effectively alignment meetings.
Absolutely.
That's what they are.
Everybody needs to be on the same page. And most importantly, that the rider is happy in terms of his program for that year. Say, all right, these are the races that we think are suited for you. And that's where the coach and the director will come in and say, we know what kind of rider you are. For example, if you're a classic specialist, we will then build you up and put you in X, Y, and Z race to say, all right, and then we want you for Milan San Remo, or we want you for you know, the Ardennes Classics or whatever it is, and that'll be the goal. And then you'll come off and you'll go on the afterburners for a while, and then you'll build up again to the next set of races.
How do you so just by way of background, I've done a little bit of work in another sport with a team, and one of the big challenges medically they face is lack of alignment. So what happened, for instance, with them is they had two ACL ruptures within about 2 weeks. Mm. One of the players got treated sort of in-house. The other one said, I'm going to go use my own doctor because he speaks my language. I'm more comfortable. I'm going to base myself at home. Those two players returned to play 2 months apart. So they lost control over the medical management of one of their players because of his own preference. How do you manage against that? And is it quite common that a rider will come and say, this is my coach, this is my preferred doctor, or do you just say, no way? You ride with this team, these are the people you work with.
Yeah, it is interesting because it's a, you know, how can you be so prescriptive in that kind of, you know, scenario where you will say, this is your doctor, this is your coach, and you fit in, basically. Again, it leads back to the it's a sport of distrust, essentially. We as a medical team have a very, very low threshold in terms of trusting people. High threshold. We don't trust anybody outside our own medical circle. And our premise and our protocols and our promise to the riders is that we will look after them 24/7, 365. They will not have to worry about a thing, provided that the communication from the rider is paramount, that they provide early communication, irrespective of language. And obviously, it's a global sport. We're working with multiple different languages. We've all had to, you know, put Duolingo on our phones and Google Translate and you name it, and we get by. But at the end of the day, we have promised that the rider that they will receive expert medical care, and they do not need to go to anybody else. So at the initial part of that is and coming on as a new team, obviously, is because also, you know, coming on as a new team and an Italian based team where things are done in a very specific way, it's difficult to break the old patterns.
Yeah, and it's important because what we've just been talking about for the previous half hour is if you lose that confidence of the guy, then he goes off and does his own thing, and then you've lost control, and your reputation is all at risk. So, that's a big deal, I reckon.
Yeah, absolutely. And you lose training days. You lose, and at the end of the day, you could potentially lose a Grand Tour because of mismanagement like that. So we have a. It's exactly that. We have a no tolerance policy to seeking external medical advice without the go ahead of your own medical team. So if a guy wants to go and get a checkup, for example. A cardiology exam, for example, and we have cardiologists that we use, but it's a guy that we will investigate and we will know and we'll trust. We'll say, right, that guy in Norway can go and have a cardiology exam. That's okay. We'll get the full report. We'll talk to the doctor, etc. So we've created that sense of trust in the beginning, and we've said, you know, we have a scientific approach to everything medical, and we will promise you absolute 100% expert care 24/7, and you need to trust us on that. And then so we are prescriptive in saying this is your doctor, and this is, and then we've developed an algorithm. So if that rider has a complaint and he contacts his doctor, we then say, right, if you don't hear back from your doctor within a 4-hour barrier rule, it's a 4-hour barrier rule that we say, well, then you go the next in your algorithm and you go to the next doctor. And within 4 hours, that rider will have an answer. And generally, it's far shorter. It's usually within half an hour that we've made contact with that rider, and so that they feel that they are being looked after, because you know it's a global sport, and trying to you can't keep fingers on your riders all the time. So comparing it to example like football or rugby, where you've got a stadium and everybody is in the same sort of geographical location, probably 99% of the squad and the not necessarily the players only, but the team as well, the staff and management all live in that same city, and so you've got access to medical care, you've got a setup, you've got you know a chain of networks that you can use immediately at your fingertips. And then you might travel, go play a game, you know, for 3 days, and you'll be back again. So it's very short-lived and very focal. Whereas talking about cycling, it's a global sport, and you're racing so much around the year. And the only contact time, physical contact time, you have with that athlete is at a race, at a training camp, and then the rest of it is digitally over telephone or email, and so trying to keep fingers on athletes and monitoring health has become very, very difficult. And that's where communication and trust comes in, because the first port of, hang on, something's wrong, the first port of call, that rider must come and say, well, who do I phone? And it must, you know, we've got to be under their favorites list.
Hopefully. So managing an issue when something's wrong is one thing, but do you have daily communication where they will fill in online questionnaires, sleep, wellness, recovery, symptom type stuff, or is it weekly, or does it not happen at all?
No, so we monitor. It's load monitoring, which is your internal and external load monitoring. So you know, obviously the internal stuff like sleep, physiological parameters, appetite, mood, travel status, jet lag, etc. Those we monitor and we keep tabs on that, and we compare that regularly to the external data, so all their training data, their race load, etc., their number of race days, and you have to correlate those two, and then we do every week we do a physiological test, an SFT test, that then does it basically what happens, it's recorded on their garments or whatever device they're using, it gets uploaded, and the coaches and the doctors can have a look at that and see how they're performing, because that's a build essentially, and it gives us weekly data.
That's like a baseline test.
Yeah.
Tells you where they are. Tell us a bit about how that works. Yeah. And what is the test?
It's a standardized power outputs.
Yeah.
And you measure the heart rates at that power.
Yes. Yeah. And you monitor those figures, and you can then see how they're progressing. And you get valuable data out of that in terms of where's that rider right now.
And is that a flat? I mean, I'm sorry to be pedantic about it, but is that a flat out test or a moderate effort level test?
No, it's a flat out test.
Flat out test. Okay.
They go.
And it's weekly.
Hard. Yeah, we try and do it weekly with them, and they do it. You know, the ideal time to do it is before a race. In fact, because then you can say if it's a week race, for example, the Dauphiné last week. You do it just before the day before, 2 days before, so you can say, all right, hang on a second, we kind of got a snapshot into where that rider is right now. And
you can say whether they're recovered, whether they're overtrained, or whether they may be undertrained.
Yeah, those are three parameters. Ideally, you want to know all that stuff before. You know, yeah. You don't just want to get it from that one test, right. And you'll know that because you're
monitoring continually.
I mean, our coaches get the data. The data literally gets the minute they finish their ride, it gets auto uploaded to a cloud, whichever platform you use. We use Training Peaks, and it all gets literally the coach can sit in his office and analyze all the data, and then feeds back immediately to that rider and says, listen, you did perfectly well, you followed the program, etc., and so the build goes, and then we get that those serial measurements, and you put that all on a graph together, and it spits out either a very nice picture or it spits out a very worrying picture. And generally, you want your internal load monitoring with your external load monitoring. Those graphs must almost be sort of superimposable.
Yeah.
Because then you know that you're hitting in the right direction. And the build towards a particular race is going in the right direction for that rider.
Yeah, and the numbers are, it's really important you interpret the numbers in the context of the qualitative feeling type stuff.
Yes, exactly.
So then that's the context that's provided
you,
then.
You have to match those. You can't take... Because there are so many different variables and confounding variables that you have to take all variables and compare them. Mm-hmm. You can't just take one variable and say, oh, hang on a second, this guy's power is 400 watts for 10 minutes. You know, wow, it's amazing. he may, you know, the next day he's going to be nowhere.
What's the context? You know, that's
so
the point.
And exactly. Yeah. So it's a very complex system, and these need weekly analysis, and that's what we do, and that all ties in very sort of neatly, hopefully most of the time neatly, but with health, because if that's all going in the right way, generally their health does move in the right direction. But again, you know, with any load, like over a 3-week tour, like you're saying earlier, trying to keep a rider healthy for 3 weeks, it's very difficult because the nature of the sport is the first week is hard and your body's pushed into overdrive, and it's the open window theory. I don't know if you've heard of the open window theory, but it's basically as your exercise load goes up, your risk of infection also goes up. So with moderate load exercise, you generally are okay in terms of your immune system. With low exercise, your immune system is generally functioning fairly well. But as that load progressively goes up, so your risk of particularly viral infections goes up. So your graphs cross.
No, because your immunity, autoimmune system is not operating optimally.
Yeah, it gets tested basically, yeah. and so your immune system is now functioning at a lower rate than usual.
Right.
Because your body's fighting other things every day. To put it in a sort of a fairly simplistic way, if you're exerting yourself at 200 k's a day, 200 beats per minute. Six hours every day, your things are going to break down,
But not every rider does that. I mean, at the end of the day, in the Tour de France, each stage will suit a certain kind of rider. So for the GC guys, they might ride all the flat stages and the medium mountain stages in the bunch, and relatively to their overall effort, they're going to be at a low effort. And then when it comes to our mountain stages, a guy like Louis Mankies, for instance, will be wanting to make a big effort there. Is that generally what happens? In other words, riders have rest days even within the race? And are you in charge of saying, okay, well, we could look at the schedule, that guy needs to give it some stick today. The next day it's going to be that guy, so he needs to rest there and sit in the bunch on that day. Is that how it's planned from medically as well?
So that's not my role. The what you've described there is the role of the director.
Yeah, but you'll know who's recovered or not.
So my role in relation to that is to say to the director, right, this guy is, and also look at our position in the race. You know, so are we in the leader's jersey, for example? Because if you're in the leader's jersey, everybody, and it's basically not pleasant for anybody because you've got to work the entire time. You've got to chase the breaks. You've got to ensure that you maintain a healthy lead. But you know, so that obviously the race situation is a factor.
Yeah.
But my link to the director is to say, all right, this rider has been riding on the front all day. I'm a little bit worried. He hasn't recovered for whatever parameters I've measured and I've clinically examined him. I'd say, well, he hasn't recovered. Is there somebody else who tomorrow then can sit in the front and give him a bit of a rest? So he could sit and he still do some work as per normal, but he's not going to be pulling and he's not going to be full gas, putting himself out there and burning every match he has because... Yeah. I have to get him through to week three.
Because in 2 days later, he's sick and he's out.
And that's the point. Yeah. So you've got to. It's a very fragile balance. You've got to monitor these things. So it's a chess game, and you've got to move your pieces very carefully. And you know you go in with a plan for a grand tour, but it very rarely, plan A very rarely works out. There's always plan B, C, D up to Z. You know, with cycling, and it doesn't.
And how do you monitor that person that's tired? How do you know that person is tired and therefore needs a rest?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, so what we do every day in the tour is obviously, you know, monitoring their load up to it. And every rider that we've selected for the tour, and the selection, as I said, would have happened in October generally. Obviously things change. There's injury, there's illness, there's, you know, situations change. But we have a general skeleton or general idea as to who we want in the tour, where management and directors and coaches will have decided. In the build up to that, we'll be monitoring health and say, right, this guy's health is okay, but, you know, for example, the Dauphiné last week had a really rough week. He's got some viral infection. Let's let him rest now. We try and recover him as much as we can. He'll have lost a few days, so maybe going into the tour, he's not going to be good in the first week, but, you know, hopefully in the week two and three, he then starts to build up.
But during the race?
So during a race, then that's the week up, and then the build up, and then during a race, you know, it starts every day with basically you start every morning with a morning ward round, so you physically see that rider, and then in a grand tour stage, we want to monitor weights and urines and things. So every morning, I get a little delivery of a urine parcel from each rider.
Every morning?
Every morning.
Really?
Every morning, yeah.
And that's being tested for, I guess, specific gravity, which is an index of hydration status, yes?
Exactly. So we don't. There's nothing other than that. It's just specific gravity, which basically tells me if that rider has been hydrating adequately enough and he's recovered his hydration levels from the day before. And then that'll guide management. You know, you say either you're fine or you need to drink a few more fluid, replace electrolytes, whatever the management is. We then measure pre-breakfast weights. So before they've had breakfast, we measure then they obviously have their breakfast. They often do a wellness score or an internal load monitoring where they say, how did you sleep? You know, what were the conditions like? You feeling okay? What's your mood like? You know, et cetera, et cetera. And then afterwards, once you're on the bus,
Going to the toilet weight?
Absolutely, yeah. So we generally try and
that can be significant when you weigh 66 kilos.
Exactly. So yeah, and these guys, you know, they're locusts, so they offload a significant volume.
You can see when they've had a muffin.
So we try and tell them to keep it as standardized. It's difficult to obviously do that on the move and when you're continually packing suitcases and trying to get out of a hotel. But we try and say, listen, try and keep it as uniform as you can. Your midstream urine the first thing in the morning, and if you can, try and bring it to me, or I'll collect it as soon as possible.
And do you look at riders sometimes and go, wow, like subjectively as a doctor with your experience, go, that guy's looking knackered today? Is there sometimes a subjective opinion there?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. That's my first thing. Yeah. You you can often see it on the bike. And you get to know your riders, their ins and outs, and okay, hang on a second, this guy's going a little bit south. And which is why it's important as well, is that we as doctors have our own riders assigned to us, but we also have to work with other doctors' riders.
Yeah.
And the benefit of working throughout the year and traveling with the team is that you will get exposed to every single rider on the squad. So you get to know every rider, ins and outs. Obviously your own riders you know better. So you're more an advantage if you have more of your riders on a tour. We do a pre-stage weight. And then finally after stage, we do a post-stage weight. So they're getting three daily weights.
Oh.
And the importance of the weight is also we want to see whether or not they, obviously you worry if a rider is losing too much weight.
Yeah.
In a grand tour particularly, their power to weight ratios change. Is it something to do with nutrition? Eventually, at the end of the day, what's going to suffer is their performance. And we also look as to whether or not, are they replacing enough? Are they getting enough food on the bike? So generally, if he's losing 3 to 4% of body weight, often they lose more. But you need to start documenting
that. Per day, they can lose more.
Yes, after a stage, they can lose sometimes 6-7% of their body weight.
Bro, it's 6 hours, and if you're sweating at 1.5 liters, and you're only replacing 500, that's 6 liters in theory.
Yeah.
Expected 3 to 4% is the average.
Yeah, as the average, and often it's more. So you just want to make sure that there's not a repeating or recurrent trend. And either, it's not only also fluid, because the other issue is glycogen. So are they eating enough on the actual bike? So is it on bike nutrition that they're eating enough? Because some guys, in the heat of the moment, they forget and they don't eat a bar for 2 hours, for example, and they haven't thought about it. But now hunger starts to kick in. Oh, hang on a second, I need to eat something. Mm. But then you're playing catch up.
Yeah.
So in this game, 3 weeks is long, but there's not a moment to lose in terms of because if you miss something, you've missed the boat, and you're trying to play catch up. If that rider's dehydrated, it's not tomorrow I'm worried about. It's 2-3 days time where their fluid depletion is going to they're going to hit a wall and that's going to be the end. So the weights are monitoring. We monitor that strictly and 3 times a day minimum. And then that all gets fed back to the coaches and to the team and to the management and say, right, this guy's, he's going a little bit south. Let's just put him on the back for a little bit and let the other guys do some, or rotate them through and not put too much pressure on them, because for stage X on Friday, we need him. It's designed for him. Let's put him in the break, for example, it's, every stage is carefully monitored and calculated. It's not like we pitch up on the start line like we do at the August cycle. I mean, the Cape Town Cycle Tour and slightly hungover probably, and ride and hope to do as best we can.
Yeah, there's a plan, is what we're saying. It's 220 Ks, 50 K of it is climbing. You know exactly what the energy cost is because you know the power output expectations. That's the beauty about cycling, is it's such a strong numbers sport that you can actually model it perfectly, and everyone's doing that.
data-centric, and you can use that data to explain to riders, and they get insight into their performance. You know, and a lot of these guys know the numbers, but a lot of the young guys who are kind of neo pros, etc., they're not used to this kind of thing, and you see that in them, and there's actually, you see light bulbs going on when they're like, you know, actually, I understand this now. And so the team meetings on the bus, you know, those are people, you know, whenever you get to start a race, you'll see that all the buses stay closed for the first half an hour. No one gets off the bus. And who's in there? It's the doctor normally, the director, the two directors, and the team, and the riders, and you know, PowerPoint presentations are going on, and strategies, and Google Maps and Google videos are saying, right, this is the cobble climb, this is the 90 degree turn, there's a headwind or a tailwind coming from this, the weather's going on, there's all these parameters that have been worked out already, you know, and putting it all into place. And going over the team strategy and saying, right, you know, Ross, today this is your role. You know, you've got to sit in the front, and you've just got to churn out numbers. And up till kilometer 75, you've got to protect Dan Martin, for example, because that's your job. And then you can, that's your job done. If you do your job, great. You know, then you've done your job. But that is a snapshot in one day, but it's a global build towards.
And they know, for instance, how many calories they've got to consume in a day as well. So you'll be working with the nutritionist and the people making the food, saying, I've covered a lot of cycle events, and I always think it's quite hilarious. You see them in the morning, they'll have breakfast, and they'll have just a bowl of pasta for breakfast, and then half an hour later they're eating again. But there's this continuous cycle of eating between the stages. That is, if you were a normal person, you'd be massively overweight. But the cost of calorie cost is huge in those events, isn't it?
Massive. I mean, the average calorie use for a tour rider is, you know, and that goes for most races, probably between 3,500 to 6,000 calories.
Yeah, mountain, you know? 6,000 in the mountains, 6,000 calories just on the bike.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I'm talking just on the bike. Never mind your basal metabolic rate and what you
plus
need to function.
2,000.
And how many? Yeah. I mean, yeah, just average. Put that into sort of real man's terms. How many burgers is that?
So you're looking at about probably about 10 McDonald's hamburgers or Wendy's or whatever you want to look at. Yeah. You're looking at about 25, nice hours Snickers, 25 Snickers bars.
Three slices of bread is 200 calories. Yeah. So 6,000 is 90 slices of bread.
So it's a loaf and a half of bread.
It's like more, 90 slices. But
I don't know how many slices.
How many slices?
Bread, but, I mean, 90 slices. That's if like all you ate was bread, you'd be. Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, you think you have leeway and freedom to go and eat 25 Snickers bars. What a pleasure, you know, just to replace what you lost on the bike. So the problem is volume. How do you as the doctor ensure that the rider is getting enough nutrition and enough volume, and because no one can physically fit that amount of food in after a race. It just, you know, in one go, particularly and over the space of, you know, 24 hours. So the basic protocol is that we have the minute the rider finishes, and obviously depends where they finish, but we always have a protein recovery shake within the first half an hour of finishing. And then they get down and on the bus, we have our chef. We have a chef for the riders, unfortunately not for the staff, but for the riders. And they will have prepared a bus meal, which contains the necessary amount of protein and carbohydrate.
For example, chicken sandwich?
So a lot of the, you know what, they're diehards. A lot of them, they just love rice and omelets. And omelets with cheese and a form of protein, chicken or ham or whatever it may be.
So high protein, not high carbs.
Both. Okay, you want to make sure you're getting both. Yeah. Because you know, you've broken down a whole lot of muscle, and also you've depleted all your glycogen. So you need to replace all of that.
And the one 50, potentially 50? It's the other.
50, because 50, is it 50-50? Protein carb?
No, it's generally more carb. I'd say about 30 grams of protein is a good bet, and about 60 to 70 grams of carb probably. Okay.
Yeah, because what the carb does is it spikes the insulin then potentiates the protein into the muscle. So the two kind of synergy
work together.
There's a synergistic kind of,
And you kind of just want to avoid that meal, particularly post-race meals of heavy fats. You have olive oils and things like that, but things that are not going to really sort of cause satiation, because you want the guy to be hungry as well. So you're not going to go and give a banting diet after a race like that. And then afterwards, you know, and then we have a 24-hour food room. So one of the hotel rooms is just 24/7. It's a food bar.
Churning up.
Unfortunately, it's one of the Swanier's rooms, but they have guys walking at 3 o'clock, and you hear the crunching of muesli and things at 3 o'clock in the morning. But they have a fruit bar. There's a and it's healthy food and often high caloric food. And then they'll go home and they'll have obviously a chef made meal which is now pre designed. It's got every day there's a menu. It's got the right amount of calories for riders. And you know the issue is yes, like you were saying, if you and I had to go and do that, we'd come home heavier than yes. we actually you know.
Well, do they end heavier or lighter than when they started?
No, the majority of them will end slightly lighter. They lose
overall.
Yeah.
2 to 5 kilos, I would have thought overall for a 75-70 kilogram guy.
It's very rider dependent though, because some riders are metronomic. They will stay on their start weight and they'll finish on that weight. Other guys will lose, and generally the general sort of progression is that you lose. But because it's a catabolic state for 3 weeks.
Negative.
But somebody who weighs 62 kilos isn't going to lose 5 kilos because that's going to be a performance.
Well, that's the thing you worry about, losing muscle mass. Then you know? So they will get skinnier, and you'll see. You know, there are guys starting the tour. I don't know if you've seen it on social media, but now it's all going around with Alejandro Valverde. He's looking skeletal. And so you always worry, because every rider's got an ideal power to weight ratio. So you also don't want to start going under that. And is he going to be too skinny to last?
Because I worry, how do you achieve that skinniness without compromising your
performance?
And that's different. I mean, Lance Armstrong next to Valverde and the other guys who finished the podium in these tours, he looked like a bodybuilder. I mean, so there's definitely something new now that is. It's just unbelievably skinny guys. Yeah. It's just
Vote pulls, yeah. Chris Froome when he wasn't ill. Like, you know, the guys are, it's all about, and that's, again, health versus
the
risk
is balance.
Tell
us a little bit about some of the things like sleep. How much do they sleep? How much do you recommend they sleep on an average day?
So, you know, the problem with the particular Grand Tour is that you're on the move. So, after a race, you hopefully, if you've had a podium or there might be doping control, you know, you're often delayed and so getting out of there is difficult. And if you're on a mountaintop finish, you know, there's extra time. You know, sometimes there'll be a police escort, but a lot of the time there's not, and you've got to wait for traffic, etc. And then a transfer to a hotel can be anywhere from 10 minutes to 400 kilometers.
Sure.
You know, so
and they're on that bus all that time.
Yeah,
10 or 4 hours.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, obviously, you know, depending, we'll try and obviously we've got team cars and we'll try and if some riders finish earlier than others, we'll send them home. We'll send them to the hotel earlier so they can get their massage done and get prepared, ready, etc. And the rest of the guys will travel back in the bus. And by the time you get to the hotel, maybe it's 7 o'clock in the evening, and then everybody still has to have massage. And that takes probably an hour and a half. There's ward rounds, there's directors that need to go and speak to riders, etc. Riders will try and get to eat usually at the same time, about 8:30, hopefully not later than that, depends on the hotel and where they are. And then we'll try and get them to bed, and usually 9:30, 10:00.
Right.
And we try and encourage sleep hygiene. So the problem with being a cyclist is you're alone because you're away from your family. And so one of the first things you do is, and with technology, is on cell phones and FaceTimes, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And you can't deny that. But what I try and encourage or discourage from the riders is that they don't watch TV and movies at night, because these guys just bring their laptops or their iPads and they sit and they watch films. And often if you're in a foreign country, you don't speak French or Spanish, for example, you'll have a download of, a memory bank of whatever film. So they sit there and they watch them. And the problem with that is you know, it's messing with melatonin and circadian rhythms and sleep patterns. And it may not affect you in the week one, but in week three, it is going to affect you. So again, it's preemptive stuff. It's making sure that your build towards that is looked after, and that sleep hygiene is practiced.
So we have sleep hygiene protocols. So you tell them to read books and not iPads and watch TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do they get themselves to sleep?
I battle with that. Yeah. So generally, you know, thankfully the fatigue factor is often the most predominant factor in getting them to sleep. But some guys need, you know, they actually go into a system of overdrive where your body's so stimulated every day from that racing that it doesn't switch off almost. You get to the stage where you're just this idling engine that can't switch off. And so sometimes, yes, you know, the question of sleep medication often comes up. And you need to weigh that up, and you need to say, what is this rider? Is this a more suggestible rider than other riders? In other words, does he have more sort of, I say addictive in inverted commas, but is he more prone to getting used to these things, and you need to give him higher doses versus some guys who are very cautious. And also, how do they respond to those medications? So, you know, like you know, muscle relaxants or benzodiazepines, which are used around the world every day in terms of muscle relaxation, reduction in anxiety, and obviously sleep. They can have a hangover effects the next day, or you know, and then the last thing you want to do is have a hungover rider, in inverted commas, again, and his concentration is not 100%, and he goes down, for example. So you need to weigh it up, and you need to know who you're dealing with. So often with sleep, you know, if guys do need it, the first thing we always prescribe is obviously just pharmaceutical grade melatonin, which is the safest and healthiest way, and often that works. But some riders say, look, you know, at the end of the, I'm in week 2.5 now, and it's just I can't sleep, etc. Then I'll give something stronger. Absolutely.
Right. Mm. And how long? I mean, how many hours do they sleep then?
They'll sleep, usually, probably some guys close on 10, 11 hours. Sure. We try and let them sleep as late as they can.
Because the stage is lost, obviously a lot later than they would be.
Exactly.
In normal amateur races.
So if the problem is the start the next day. If the start's close, often they can have breakfast at 9 o'clock, and so they can wake up. Any 5 to 9, you know, we'll set it as late as possible. And then every day there's a schedule, so right, and it says rider wake up at, and that time is the latest that they can wake up, and breakfast at until, and then suitcases in the bus at this time, etc., etc. So there's a very strict protocol and program every day. Otherwise, you arrive late at the start, and then it's trouble. Awesome. So we try and encourage minimum sort of 9, 10, 11 hours of sleep a night. I do get woken up in the middle of the night. The guy can't sleep. We've had guys, you know, their partners have been snoring, they've moved their mattress out into the corridor and slept in the corridor, you know, things like that. I've given up my bed and said, well, sleep in my bed, I'll go and sleep outside. You know, at the end of the day, the recovery is absolutely paramount. If you're not sleeping, which is a massive part of that, we have to prioritize that. Mm. I mean, that's
the hygiene. That must be an interesting one to tackle when you're traveling to so many places, buses, hotels, food.
Very difficult. And so I kind of feel a bit like a school teacher when I'm there every day, because I'm shouting at naughty children is every day wash your hands. And I on the bus particularly, there's a toilet on the bus, and so we have copious amounts of hand gels, you know, waterless and soap. And there's a lot of marketing basically. So have you washed your hands, etc. And we also encourage no touching of fans' hands, in fact. So a lot of riders will come up to the start and they'll hand high five. The next thing, somebody hasn't, you know, cleaned their hands properly, you've got something on their hands. Next thing you go and reach in your pocket, you have an energy bar, and then we've gone and then we've got something viral and there's a diarrhea, and then that stuff spreads like wildfire. So
you quarantine the guy when that happens.
Absolutely.
That's the first thing you do. You're sleeping on your own.
Some guys love that though. They'll feign an illness to get their own room. Get my own room. But that again is the doctor's role, is to be vigilant of that and watch them and say, hang on a second, even if this is a functional diarrhea, in other words, it's not coming from a viral or organic cause, a viral or bacterial cause. It's more of like a
something ate.
It's more from a sort of like often a high carbohydrate load where you get a massive osmotic gradient, because the glucose in the gut, it absorbs all the water and just shunts everything out. They're not ill, but they're potentially becoming dehydrated, which is one thing you got to monitor. But even if it was that, even if I don't know what kind it is, I said, guy's a bout of diarrhea, off you go. And I'll phone ahead to the soigneur who's at the next hotel setting things up already. Please separate a room, or arrange, get a separate room for this rider, et cetera, et cetera.
Hygiene of the nethers. I mean, I remember in the old days they used to use medical spirits and then take a towel afterwards and then get in there to try and clean up. I mean, that's obviously a high chance of things happening down there after 3 weeks of riding. I suppose professional riders, it's a daily problem, really, isn't it? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it isn't because they're you know, their perennial areas are so conditioned. You know, it's like us sitting in an office chair every day. You know, we're just used to it, and they are used to sitting on that small saddle. That's what they do for 4 or 5 hours of the day.
Yeah.
So those areas are not calloused, but they're primed. In other words, there's a toughness to that skin. That said, they are just as prone to getting saddle sores as your weekend warrior is riding an epic, which is what we see. And you know, you've heard of the bum. You've been to the bum clinic.
It's a nasty place to work.
It is, and it's you know, and it provides a very, very important function, because it keeps guys in their saddles essentially. And the same thing with what happens over a grand tour is because nobody trains like you race a grand tour.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't spend that amount of hours, even if you are a professional cyclist. So skin breaks down in the end. And so Yeah, the you know, we don't use sort of spirits anymore because, you know, if there is any broken skin, they just I'm going to be the one who's going to cop it in the end. But what we do is in the showers we have special betadine, so and iodine based solutions, which are aseptic solutions, and they initially wash with that straight away. So my rule is the minute you get off your bike, you are out of your chamois. Get your bib shorts off, because that warm, moist environment, that is a sort of a already a, just
it's a dangerous experiment. Environment
for yeah exactly. So you want to avoid that. Get out of your kit. Get into a nice loose kit and clean quickly. And then obviously we do an inspection if there's something going on. And then we treat as necessary. Whether that's just a basic cream or zinc oxide or something like that. Throw in an antibiotic or an antifungal cream as well. And then whether something they may need some steroid on top of that to diminish the skin reaction. But the point is you've got to get them back, because you can't say, well, go and rest for 2 days.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. You know, you've got to keep them on the bike. And where sometimes they need dressings, but the problem with putting a dressing under there is that you're putting a dressing in an area that is already compromised for space, you know. So you don't want to go and fill that with more space, with more space occupying material. Yeah. Yeah. So often a dressing can cause more issue.
Yeah.
So it might be a hard day for that rider. He's got to do a lot of climbing, out of the saddle stuff, but we get them through.
So, Tejan Rutuna, it's been a fascinating insight into your job with these teams. Ross, final comments from you?
No, I just really enjoyed the insight. Yeah. It's cool to have a perspective from inside the race. And obviously, listeners will hear this podcast during the tour, so you'll be able to watch it knowing that there's a fella in a team car fixing saddle sores and doing whatever else when you're not seeing the cameras on the riders. It's just been really good insight, I think, for anyone watching the tour. So thank you very much, Adrian.
Adrian, you're the thing you most look forward to at the end of all this. What do you do when it's all over?
The thing I look forward to most is, I suppose it's after the hype and the pressure, it's actually just, it's breathing out. I find for the 3 weeks you hold your breath, and it's a nervous breath. And if things work out, you breathe out, you hug your family, and that for me is the moment. And just getting home, and it's a long month on the road, and yeah. Ultimately you're getting back to home soil, and just knowing that you've gotten hopefully 8 guys through a 3 week race. That's the best we can hope.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.